AI is making waves in every field it touches. President Biden is now on TikTok, and the election draws closer each day. With so much going on in the world, it is hard to keep up with it all, let me tell you. Hi, I'm Kai Ryssdal, the co-host of Make Me Smart. It's a podcast from Marketplace. And every weekday, Kimberly Adams and I break down the latest in business and the economy with short daily episodes to make it easy for you to stay in the know. Listen to Make Me Smart wherever you get your podcasts.
Vanity Fair.
Hello and welcome to Little Gold Men, the award season podcast from Vanity Fair.
I am delighted and proud to introduce him as Academy Award winner.
And the Oscar goes to.
And the Oscar goes to.
The winner, it's a tie.
And any little girl who's practicing their speech on the telly, you never know.
Mom, I just want an Oscar.
I'm David Canfield, and I am here for this week's interview episode with Chris Murphy. Hi, Chris.
Hi, David.
So between you and me, we have interviewed two actresses this week who are pulling double duty. You spoke with Andrea Riseborough, who is the scene-stealing supporting star of The Regime on HBO. She just had a big episode air. You may have also heard some of her conversation on Still Watching if you are a dedicated VF listener. And she's also the lead of her own show called Alice and Jack. So we're going to talk about that. But first, I spoke with Amy Ryan, who is in the television series Sugar. She's the female lead opposite Colin Farrell. And she's also currently on Broadway.
Oh, yeah.
That little thing. In Doubt. And we actually have a fuller profile up on VF.com right now. But Chris, what do you want to know about Amy Ryan?
Everything. I mean, she jumped into that show at the last possible minute for Time Daily. So that's got to be a crazy experience, right?
Yeah. She told me, we had a few meetings in addition to the Little Gold Men interview for the profile. And she told me that... it's finally fun for her now, which I thought that was a nice way of putting it, that she said the panic has subsided. And I'm like,
I have to imagine, yeah, that there's nothing more terrifying than becoming the lead of a Broadway show in basically 2 days flat. Who can do that?
Amy can do it. Our Little Gold Men conversation is mostly focused on Sugar. She plays kind of former rock star who's struggling with alcoholism and becomes the kind of right-hand man to Colin Farrell's detective. It's this really stylized noir show, and she gets a great showcase part. So let's hear the conversation with Amy Ryan. Amy, you are here to talk about Sugar, which is a new Apple TV Plus series. You and I spoke earlier today about Doubt because you just happen to be the lead of a Broadway show right now. How does it feel to be talking about a television show that you shot a while ago in the midst of a pretty intensive stage run?
Yeah, it's, you know, when it looks like someone's an incredibly busy actor because projects come out simultaneously, but obviously, as you mentioned, it was a year apart, if maybe even a little more. So, but I was able to see the whole series before Doubt started, the run of Doubt. I actually had time when I had time in my life. So I am a bit more familiar with it, but it's a very different experience, obviously, seeing a finished product than from, you know, when you're creating it.
Yes, indeed. How did the show strike you when you watched it? I'm also just curious, given that we can't spoil certain things about this show, there are some big twists, so we'll avoid that, but even just broad impressions.
I was gobsmacked when I first saw it, truly. Like, I was stunned visually. I knew it was going to be something other than standard, maybe, points of view of camera setups. Fernando Morales and Cesar Chalón, RDP, like, Cesar would be in very creative spots, either up a ladder on a rafter or in the back trunk of that little convertible Corvette, suddenly two cameras would be rolling, but then an iPhone would come, you know, right across your eyes, you know. So I knew they were up to something other. I just didn't know what it was going to look like. But I think it is visually stunning, and it makes Los Angeles a very prominent character in this story.
It does, and it's interesting because I associate you with, I mean, obviously we're talking about your Broadway role, but also your most recent series role was Only Murders in the Building. It's a very iconic New York show. You're a very noted New York actor. How did it feel not only shooting in LA, but like doing this very LA noir Hollywood history kind of story?
Yeah. That was the attraction to be, you know, after so long, like, where can I find something new? You know, I've repeated myself sometimes too much with wives and girlfriends, and then the idea of a former punk rocker, you know, successful, you know, really successful in her 20s and very much a financially successful adult, has her own home and her car and, you know, family, that I never played someone so cool. You know, and I certainly didn't attempt to try to emulate a Kim Gordon or a Patti Smith, but certainly those cool women who, you know, they just so gracefully and true to the number they are. They, you know, they make me eager to grow older. So that was new. And Los Angeles is always a bit of a challenge for me just because I am a homebody and I want to be with my family. But I like this character and I wanted to work with Colin so bad. I just think he's extraordinary. And the show was also helping me get back home. I gained a lot of frequent flyer miles. But it did, like, it did make me look at LA with different, you know, different lens. And I think into that noir world, but again, you know, you're shooting it and it's 100 degrees up at the Griffith Observatory. It doesn't feel that sexy noir. You're just like, this is hot. 100 degrees in the valley. On my first day, I thought I'm going to melt. What's going on with my girl? So, you know, that part, I needed a bit of navigating around to get back to the script.
Fair enough. The nature of this part is fascinating in terms of how I think of your work, because if I think of something like Only Murders or even The Office in your television roles, the natures of those characters comes out a little bit more slowly over time. And in this show, in your first episode, she's at her biggest, right? She's at her most destructive, and she's therefore at her loudest in a lot of ways.
Yeah.
I'm wondering what it felt like to enter into this world kind of at a 10, especially when you're opposite Colin Farrell with all these crazy camera setups, as you say.
Yeah. That first scene in the bar where she's had too much to drink and she shouldn't be drinking. And she's singing along to the recorded song in the bar. That felt like, you know, just being the new kid in school, even though I was there from the beginning of production, you know, it just was like, oh God, we're starting with this scene. And in a weird way, it's a little bit helpful because you don't know the crew yet. And there's a sense like maybe they don't notice me here. Okay, I'll just do this and try to get through it. But I'm not a singer. And I read that scene initially thinking, oh, she's drunk and she's alone at the bar and she's singing quietly to herself into her little cup. Mm. And then Fernando was like, no, she's enjoying, she's drunk and she's thinking about when she was performing in her 20s. So, you know, turn out. Mm-hmm. I was like, oh, God. Every like bone in my body just like, but then, you know, Colin and I had kind of an instant rapport and were able in the scene to kind of overlap and be playful with each other. And that certainly loosened it up and set the tone going forward. So I felt much more at ease and able to, she makes some pretty bold assumptions about his character and herself, you know, setting up the kind of the tone that they're kindred spirits and that they both have something to hide. So that was kind of the soother from the first part of the scene where, you know, singing is just so intimate, you know, mm-hmm. you have to obviously keep pace and it's over when the song's over and you can't speed that mm-hmm. up as much as I wanted to. Mm.
It's a good way of putting it though, especially with a character like this, you're introducing kind of what made her a legend to some people in this world through her voice.
Yeah. And that I feel is kind of hard to sell in a weird way when someone says of any character, oh, they're the best or they were this. So they, mm-hmm. you know, and like, okay, well, how? Not certain. Obviously, there are many singers who don't have great voices, but they have this other. They're incredible musicians. Mm-hmm. They have this charisma and, you know, it all is within a package. So, but that just on top of it being the very first day, the very first scene on a new set. And it's intimidating, but I also relied on some editors to help me out. Get away from the scene. So
there you go. I will say you did give me a little Patti Smith there. So if this is the closest we get to Amy Ryan doing Patti Smith, I think should all be satisfied.
I'll take it from you. I'll take it.
I wanted to ask you a little bit about living in this filming style. You've worked in television a lot. You've been through, I think, a lot of different TV eras. And this is one that's kind of unique for you in that it's a part of this, I think, a little bit more filmmaker-driven, visually-driven storytelling. You mentioned Fernando Morales, an Oscar nominee, who brings this, like, really fascinating aesthetic. Like, as someone who's worked in TV a lot and a lot of different kinds of television, how did you find being in that sort of version of it, I suppose, which is a little bit more modern?
Well, because the Collins character has this affinity and this passion for old Hollywood film, and you see his character flash on images or from an actual footage is used as he's figuring out his missing person's case or figuring out why a person might behave that way. It springs to mind for him an iconic part of the film. Mm-hmm. And, early on when we filmed, my character goes to an AA meeting. And that is kind of, you know, we've seen AA meetings 100 times over in film and television. And I remember the day we shot it and I stood at the front of the room and there were people in folding chairs and coverage was front and back and that's that. And then Fernando, like it was like a day later or so, he said, oh, I want to show you the scene. And the edited version, which I was glad to see up front in the production because it was obviously a direct line into his thinking and into this production, was using all those clips. So as I'm speaking in my chair and Colin is reacting to it, you see all the other images. I think it was like Elizabeth Taylor's in there and, you know, these flashes, and they're almost like, you know, what, 2-3 seconds of a scene. So that is a great way to transport us into something else. I also wondered, I'm like, oh, well, did I earn this emotional impact of the scene? Or am I being supported by these iconic films, these you know, legendary actors? Probably a little bit of both. I'll take it.
That's good filmmaking,
yeah,
though.
it's like, and maybe it's no different than like what a score does, right? You know, leads us emotionally towards something. But that was just a great dive into how this show is going to be different in the way in which the story is told. It's not a straightforward detective whodunit, you know.
No.
Just meet the next person, get the next clue, go to the next scene and get another clue. It's not that.
It's also the kind of, I don't think it's too much of a spoiler to say that, you know, I don't think I understood or knew like the scope of your role in the first episode or even the first two. And it only becomes clear how central you are to the story, to Colin's character's development, you know, over the course of it. There's an unpredictability there that I liked. So how did you find charting her arc in this season?
Well, I credit Colin. You know, on paper and early on in the script, my character was, you know, the femme fatale, and soon they were going to get in bed to, you know, together and be this couple. And he very rightly said, but then what? You know, mm-hmm. That's episode two. We have a long way to go. And I was sold right away. I was like, he's like, what about actual friendship? Like real friendship. And I can't recall seeing that or recently, mm-hmm. don't, you know, where they really, there is an attraction. There is a familiarity that they see within each other. Some kind, something is there. They know each other has secrets. It allows them to slowly break down walls and also, you know, allows each other to disappoint them, you know, disappoint each other with an understanding, if that makes sense. Mm-hmm. Like, you know where that pain is coming from. And I think once any two characters get in bed, the dynamic shifts, the power shifts, and it's over. It would have been a character then, I'm guessing. I don't want to belittle a team of writers, but it would have been like, oh, then what happened, honey? Mm-hmm. How did you feel, honey? You know, and now she becomes like a real confidant and still is a bit of a mystery. You know, is she connected? Does she know more than she's letting on? And I think like that scene, I hope it doesn't give it away, but there's a moment where like, they just hold hands mm-hmm. and it breaks my heart. Cause it's like, it's so solid a moment where she's accepting of him. She knows he is damaged. He has secrets and she says, it's okay.
Yeah, it's a really moving moment. I can see it, even though I watched it a little while ago, I remember it. I think what you're talking about, too, is something you mentioned earlier, which is that not wanting to repeat those kinds of love interest girlfriend roles that Hollywood so loves. and I remember we talked about that a little bit with Only Murders in the Building, because, again, it's the kind of thing where you're watching it and, you know, you have very famous actor that you are playing opposite and it's great. And then what? And in that show's case, you get to have like the time of your life, which was fun. But I wonder if that's something that has probably become more important for you as an actor too, to just keep those roles more interesting.
For sure. And, you know, and especially with this experience on Broadway with Doubt, like, being a character that drives the story and her point of view is very important to the audience. It's more fun. It's more creative. It engages my brain more, you know, all of the above. And again, like I say, like, oh, I like to be a homebody. So if I'm going to get up and especially travel to Los Angeles or another location, like I really want to be happy about that. You know, mm-hmm. I want to have something to play with while I'm away, because otherwise it's just too lonely. it's and boring.
The run through of Vogue is where you'll meet all the most exciting people in fashion and culture.
I am Fran Lebowitz, who should be the mayor of New York.
We all support that. We support that.
Very nice.
Nikki.
Yes.
It's been really great being in this beautiful pink room.
All right, Usher, can you hear us?
I can hear you.
All right.
Can you hear me?
We can.
We can.
All right, here we are.
On the podcast, you'll learn how Vogue really works.
Sometimes we'll come in for a second or even third run through until we are AWOK.
Can you tell us what AWOK means?
It means AWOK, Anna Wintour OK.
I'm Cho Minardi.
And I'm Chloe Mel.
And we're the hosts of The Run Through with Vogue, where fashion and culture collide.
Join us. It's AWOK.
Listen and subscribe wherever you get your podcasts.
Let's talk about Colin Farrell a little bit. You guys are wonderful together. He gives a really fantastic performance as the titular Sugar. Mm-hmm. But you've already alluded to, you know, the joy you felt working with him. So, yeah, how did that relationship develop?
We have mutual friends, and so that's always a great icebreaker, you know, and easy to talk for hours about those friends and why we love them. And then Colin, by nature, he's just a curious guy, and he's generous, and he's so buoyant in his energy. He lifts everyone on that set, cast and crew alike, and I just find him. I mean, I keep, you know, when we were working together, that was the time when Banshees of Inisherin was out and I'd gone to see it actually a few times. And it was great to go see that film on screen and then go to work the next day and see this very different performance. And, you know, it's not that I needed to be reminded how varied his roles are and how extraordinary an actor he is, but it was just so mesmerizing to do that. And then also see him as, like, it's one thing, I assume, to like work on a film and the script is complete, but now here you are in a series and he really has to keep an eye on the whole arc that isn't even really written yet as a producer, and then still be our leading man, you know, performing actor. And he's just so smart. And, you know, coupled with our producer, Audrey Chan, and Sam Catlin, a writer, producer, they really found this way towards the end and our twist and earning it. I think the twist earned.
Mm-hmm. I think so too. Was this positioned to you as a one season deal? Is it something you would do again?
Yeah, it was a one season deal. Yeah. Which is, yeah, suits me just fine. And which is also like Only Murders.
I was going to say, just fine, in treatment too.
I went back to Only Murders a couple of times, and it was so lovely to go back because I had such a blast on that show, and I had a blast on this one too. So if it resonates with an audience and it goes back and I pop in with that dog, that's okay. But it felt complete to me. So I don't feel like, what's more? What's next? No.
Yeah. How do you find acting with a dog?
Well, that dog, oh my God. That's
a great dog.
That was a rescue dog. Wow. And we all fell for it. Oh, Wiley. You could hear so many people say to the trainers, like, you know, if you're looking for a home for that dog, I'd take it. You know, everyone wanted to adopt the dog. But I guess I haven't worked with many animals, but I think that dog was extraordinary and would do things instinctively. Like, it would just like turn, especially Colin. He was very close with Colin, like at certain moments, and Fernando, they were all like, oh my God, look quick. And they had cameras going and, you know, he was doing his side at the coverage. And you know, he was very, very aware emotionally what was going on. And it's also like it's such a great stress reducer at work. You're just so happy to pet this dog. But yeah.
You mentioned earlier that the show sort of opened up, you know, showed you Los Angeles with gave you new eyes for it. What particularly stuck out to you anew about it as you were shooting the show, going to some of those locations?
I think when I'm in Los Angeles, my scope can be very kind of kind of straightforward. I'll go here, I'll go there, I'll go to work, I'll go home. And then there's some of those, it's just more of a sweeping view. And, you know, anyone could go to the Griffith Observatory and see a sweeping view of Los Angeles, but it's also something, it's also like I was sharing with you earlier today about like a kid part of you that's an actor that when you daydream about, oh, someday I want to be in a movie or someday I want to be in a play. And Colin and I had that moment where we just started giggling. It was silly, you know, it doesn't mean much, but we were in that 1964 blue convertible Corvette driving down Hollywood Boulevard with the top down, and he was going a little too fast, and we just started giggling. He's like, what the hell do you think, you know, a kid from Dublin and a girl from Queens have the right to be in this car right now, you know? And just the sense of like knowing where you came from and appreciating where you came from, because that allows you to appreciate where you are now. And, you know, I'm not a big car aficionado, but like if you're going to be in Los Angeles, it's kind of a wonderful trope to be driving in.
Like, you guys look insanely cool in that car.
And then
you do.
There's a scene where I read the script where I get to drive the car. It's like, oh my God, this is too much. This is too much. You know, but so that part of it is like, just gives you a goose. It's fun.
Do you remember the first like show you filmed in Los Angeles?
Yes, I do. It was an episode of Quantum Leap.
And the original Quantum Leap.
I didn't know anything from anything but my agent at the time, Tim Carnahan, who I mentioned today.
Yes, we talked to him.
He had another client in the same episode who was more experienced, and she looked out for me. He told her. He said, Amy's never done anything. And she showed me what a mark was. And that was at the time. Like, I don't know why. Like, today, I would say, like, oh, I've never done this before. What do I do? What's the mic? What I don't overlap. I stand there. But I just felt like if then I was just so nervous and try to be the good girl and let me pretend I know. I don't want anyone to fire me or, you know, mess this up. So anyway, Nancy, she said, that's your mark. You stand there. Don't overlap the dialogue. But I hadn't seen the show at that point, and I didn't know it jumped back in time. So I remember my costume fitting was like serious 80s. And I was like, well, this is a little dated, but I guess this is what I wear. Fine. But I thought it was such a huge deal, too. I was so excited. You know?
That show was huge.
Yeah.
Well, I would bet the Amy of then would not have imagined herself in the Corvette driving down Hollywood Boulevard.
She'd be psyched. Her head would have imploded, though. So it's a good thing it happened so many years later. I can hear.
There you go. A beautiful Hollywood story.
All my dreams.
So, Chris, now we're going to turn to your interview with Andrea Riseborough. What a spring she's having. What can you tell me about your conversation?
Yeah, I mean, she's also, as you said, pulling double duty between the regime and Alice and Jack. And I feel on the regime, we're seeing her sort of more in the Andrea Riseborough that we know. She's playing a character. She's sort of not unrecognizable, but really, you know, in this sort of absurd comic, darkly comic place lane that I think we come to expect from an actress with the range of Andrea Riseborough. But on Alice and Jack, it's a much sort of more grounded, more naturalistic, closer performance to who she really is. And we talked about how she based the accent for the character, like, you know, just down the road from where she grew up in Northern England, and how she sort of tapped in to this really damaged, really kind of prickly woman over the course of a really beautiful, quiet two-hander of a series with Domhnall Gleeson. Mm.
Many listeners of this podcast were, of course, introduced to her through the dizzying last-minute Oscar campaign.
Speaking of last-minute.
for To Leslie, that, of course, resulted in a rather shocking nomination. And there was a lot of swirling attention around her. I would imagine she's quite happy now to be able to focus on the work.
Yeah, we talked about her return to the Oscars this year as just a guest, not a nominee. And what that was like to sort of be out of the spotlight, but still in that arena. And I feel that, yeah, she's very happy to sort of do what she does best and what she loves doing. She's an actress who loves acting, and you can really feel that in her performances and in talking to her. She's an actor's actress.
I can't wait to hear all the things about acting from Andrea Riseborough.
Wow, Andrea Riseborough, I am so thrilled to be talking to you about The Regime. I have to say, this episode 5, ended with quite a bang and a pretty sad ending for Agnes, I must say.
And also sort of in so many ways, she leaves as she came, in the sense that she, you know, she moves through the building ghost-like through this very sort of protected, insular, very wonky, unhealthy bubble that they all exist in. She sort of moves around like a ghost through the rooms. And the moment that she leaves us is so silent and shocking and tragically subtle.
Exactly. It is tragically subtle. I mean, we were saying it's so not an event. It is not filled with fanfare. It happened so fast. We almost weren't sure if maybe she fell, maybe it didn't happen. And I think that sort of speaks to how violence like this, when it erupts, this just people just drop like flies. It's so...
The horrible, faceless fallout of war, I think, is what it underlines.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think we were wondering, and I was wondering, you know, we see Agnes, she has a phone, she has a way out. She's so close. She's so close to getting out of the palace and to getting out with Oscar. And if she had just acted a little bit sooner and left a little bit before it all came crumbling down, maybe she would have gotten out alive. Why do you think she held on to the regime, to the palace, for as long as she did?
I think Agnes probably wouldn't have continued to be complicit working in the palace had her son not been suddenly found in great favor by Elena. And that just complicated Agnes's whole situation to the point where she found herself co-parenting with a dictator, which is trying at the best of times, and was unable to sort of extract him and save him from this very flighty, powerful figure, you know, and at any moment he could fall out of favor. So she's desperately trying to preserve his life, really. And in order to do that, she has to stay close to Elena and she has to stay within the palace. And she's sort of trapped, essentially. The moment that she decides to make a break and flee, which really is the sort of decision, in a sense, it's suicide because so few people manage to escape.
Yeah.
But it seems like the lesser of two evils, you know, whichever way you look at it. And it's, of course, deeply unsuccessful.
That relationship, that co-parenting with Chancellor Elena is so, it's so complicated and nuanced and yet so clear the power dynamic in terms of Agnes having to defer to whatever Elena's whim is of the week to keep Oscar alive. Can you talk a little bit about how you both, you and Kate, discussed that relationship, how you sort of found that? Because it's so central to Agnes's story and so interesting for the viewer.
We talked a lot before, when we were shooting Lee, we were shooting a film before the regime, Kate and I, and as we were shooting Lee, there were moments when we just touched on having conversations about Elena and Agnes's relationship in what was then called the palace and ended up being called the regime. At the time, I made a film in Belgium, a French film with Catherine Deneuve, and my character had gone through chemotherapy, so I had a shaved head, and my hair was kind of growing back, just in its beginning tufty stages of growing back at that time. And Kate and I discussed the idea that perhaps Elena had, because of her own insecurities, requested Agnes keep her hair short. You know, that she's stripped her, as our own private backstory, she's stripped her in a sense of her, of what was perhaps a former identity, and removed kind of anybody else's. You know, she's so powerful, and her, as much as anything else, her sexuality controls the palace. So that was just an interesting thing that Kate and I worked on a little, and that was one of the ways that Agnes was totally repressed. But I think just the thing that I really liked that we landed on with Agnes was that originally she wasn't really particularly from anywhere, and there was an allusion to it perhaps having formerly run this huge palace that they're all trapped in, and that there'd been a usurpation of her power by Elena, and so perhaps it was once Agnes's place. And I suggested to Will that perhaps Agnes instead should be of, it should be working class, should represent in some way the proletariat, the people outside whose decisions are being made for them by some very disconnected people inside of this horrible
walls.
Regime.
Absolutely.
And so perhaps, because you see that in Matthias's character, Zubak, you get a sense of the people, but he's still been harnessed as a weapon.
Mm-hmm.
And he's on the verge of real madness at this point, whereas Agnes is, I'm pleased that we landed with her being representing the working classes, because she's, through her you get to see the long-suffering pawn,
yeah,
you know, in this in this giant game of political chess? Who's being sort of most affected by these decisions?
I totally, even something that's interesting about the regime is all the accents are a little bit different. Like yours is, you know, a little bit more northern, and then, you know, Kate is doing her sort of Margaret Thatcher lisp. Interesting, such interesting work. But it all gives a place, a sense of place in terms of location and where they might fall on a class spectrum, which
in
I think is
hierarchy.
Interesting.
Mm-hmm. That was the interesting thing about doing it with a British accent. There is such a horrible hierarchy that we, in a sense, through that accent, were able to lean on, through all of its nuances, we were able to lean on that hierarchy, even though it feels very Eastern European as a place, but we're in an imaginary place. So it's kind of, you know, it's representing so many horrific regimes. And so, and in it, part of why it's also so hysterically funny is because I think in it you see something articulated that's deeply politically familiar. It's not specific, but the ridiculousness of it is such that you can't help but laugh out loud because it's so inefficient and useless.
Yeah.
You know, the whole structure is so far away from any kind of social reform that it's just ridiculous.
Absolutely. And it is funny. I mean, that tone, I would love to hear how you as an actress sort of tackled that tone, because you're so right that in one moment it's, you know, kind of absurd, ridiculous, and we're seeing Zubak slather mustard on Kate Winslet's chest and, you know, rub it on her. And in the next, we're having these, you know, seeing a mother taken from her son in a violent coup. And that's a tricky tone to balance, to shift between the sort of absurdly comic and the truly dark and horrific. So how did you manage that?
Yes, quite. I'd almost forgotten about the mustard on Kate's boobs.
Hard to forget once you see it.
maybe I've blocked it out. Will is such a brilliant writer, and the material is almost sort of Shakespearean in a sense where, you know, it holds tragedy and a lot of comedy. And it's quite theatrical as well, and it's quite, there's something, even though it's set in modern day, that is quite sort of strangely period about it, in the sense that this country seems like a timeless, you know, geographically vague place. But I come from the northeast of England, which is a place that's very resilient, hardworking, very, very dry, cutting humour.
Yeah.
And Agnes doesn't come from that same place. She comes from a bit further south. But I think leaning on that world-weary, resilient sort of humour that comes from people who've multi-generationally been workers was very useful, playing Agnes, to strike that balance between total despair and sheer dismissal. And through Agnes's dismissal, that, you know, it can often be very funny the way that she's beyond her wit's end with the situation that's going on around her. No, there's no sane figure to cling on to, really, other than the guy that she's sort of having a relationship with.
Yeah.
Peter. Nobody's safe, really. Nobody's safe, because everybody's in an impossible moral situation where they're unable to kind of behave as the best part of themselves.
It was so clear by the end of episode 5, seeing Agnes sort of brutally and violently taken from us so quickly without any fanfare, that was really who we were rooting for in the show. There's, you know, you can't, we're not really rooting for Zubak. We're not really rooting for Elena. We're interested and compelled by them and want to see what they do with this mess. But the heart of the show and the person that you're rooting for lack of a better word, is Agnes. So that, it was tough to see her go in such a manner because of that.
Poor old Agnes.
Yeah, I want to know, you mentioned you were working on Lee with Kate Winslet before shooting this. You've collaborated with her a bunch of times. She's a huge fan of your work, as has been documented. What is it like to work opposite Kate Winslet, and to, what's your working relationship now that you've, you know, worked together?
Just such a, you know, such a a huge privilege, a joy, a total pleasure. She's just the kindest, loveliest, most brilliant, amongst many other things, leader. She's a wonderful person to have at the head of a project, because she sets the tone in such a generous and very playful way. And she's so funny and lovely, and every day has boundless energy, you know. It's just wonderful to be in that environment where you feel like everybody is so muscularly engaged in, you know, finding out what could be the best possible path. When I first read the script of The Regime, I thought, and I knew that Kate was playing Elena, I just wanted to be in orbit of this, because I was crying sort of with laughter and thinking about Kate playing the part even before I'd heard her put a speak a word of the character. Just really, really so wonderful to see that come to life.
I will say, I'm excited for the final episode, but justice for Agnes, you know, I'll miss her. I'll miss her.
Agnes. Right.
I'm David Remnick, host of the New Yorker Radio Hour. There's nothing like finding a story you can really sink into that lets you tune out the noise and focus on what matters. In print or here on the podcast, The New Yorker brings you thoughtfulness and depth and even humor that you can't find anywhere else. So please join me every week for The New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.
Well, a big shift, because, you know, Agnes and The Regime, but you play sort of a wildly, completely different character in Alice and Jack. And so I'll sort of switch modes and we'll talk about your other major show, which really is a love story, the likes of which I have never seen before and hope not to experience, at least as of, you know, the end of episode 3. Can you talk a little bit about these two, Alice and Jack? They clearly are meant to be. They're clearly cosmically linked, and yet they can't seem to make it work. Why do you think that is?
I'm always really interested in reading stories, and this is what happened when this script came to me. Reading stories that represent all sorts of different kinds of life. And you know, everybody goes through different things. We all of us have different stories. And everyone's great love story, whatever it looks like, is worth being told. And in this story, the character that I play, Alice, has been through some horrific stuff. And, you know, it makes her spicy.
Yeah.
She can be cutting. And she's not felt love in this way. And she, like everyone else, you know, speaking from her perspective, deserves her own love story. You know, all of these beautiful love stories that may not end looking like a film set in a fancy apartment in New York or with a struggling protagonist who's living in like a four-bedroom apartment in New York.
Huge. I've seen that before.
And wonderful, and that has its place, those like real romantic comedies in the most broad sense, don't always represent what love looks like. It's such a mess and it's so confusing. And I think more than anything, love is that great challenge it holds up that great mirror to you, where all of your darkest fears bubble to the surface. You behave like the worst version of yourself in spite of wanting to present yourself as being completely perfect.
Yeah.
And you kind of can't get a handle on reality because, your imagination runs away with everything, starts bubbling, like you're simmering in a pot and all of those insecurities come up. And we used to have a camera very close to somebody in those moments.
Yeah.
You know, intimately and in an honest way, I think it would look a little more like this story does. Because none of us are presenting the best of ourselves often when we're in love because we're the most scared, we have the most to lose, you know.
As you mentioned, Alice, particularly as a really dark backstory, there's, you know, a terrible relationship with her father who abused her. Her mother was aware of that. These are very dark places and dark things about her past that I have to imagine as an actor, it's difficult to tap into. So how do you explore that and also stay relatively sane as a human being and go
on? Well, I produced this show and so I was working on it 5 years before we actually shot it. And or have been working on it 5 years now. Sorry, so all in all, it's been 5 years. So working on it for about 3 years before we shot it, and then we shot it the year before last, and it's now coming out. And I think probably one of the most challenging things was that our writer, creator, Vic, Alice was very clear on the page, but at the beginning we had the first and the final episode, so I knew we were starting and we were finishing, as did mm-hmm. Donal, playing opposite me, playing Jack. Yeah. And we knew where we were going to end up, but we didn't have the meat yet. We didn't have the what was going to happen in the center. So as Vic came to know me and Donal and I better, he began to take parts of our lives, you know. Mm-hmm. And when you're playing a character who's been through such a great deal historically, and then they're mixed with little snippets of yourself, familiar snippets of yourself. As an mm-hmm. example, her voice is quite close to mine. It's only about 5 miles down the road from where I grew up. It's not exactly how I sound, but it's similar. Mm-hmm. There's lots of things that are very, close to me, and pieces of information that Vic had garnered from my own life that he then sort of peppered into the script. And that was very psychologically confusing. I'm not sure I would want to do that again.
Yeah.
And I probably will somewhere along, you know, down the line. But it's very strange because you start almost rewriting your own past. You know, it just gets, everything gets a bit crossed and wonky in your brain. When you're playing a character for, you know, 6 months and you've been working on it for, and we're now processing it. It's out in the world and we're sharing it with people now. So it was a very unique experience in that sense. And Vic is very perceptive, and so was able to really, like, sponge, absorb both Donal and I in that way.
Yeah, wow, that is really intense. And for a show that is so much about love and is so, you have to believe from the second these two meet, Alice and Jack, that there is something bigger than them that is keeping them together, given how it plays out. Your chemistry with Donal is so wonderful and so complicated and grounded and natural and funny and flirty. I have to imagine that doesn't happen with every scene partner that you have. How did you land on Donal for the part? What was it like working together? Because it really, it's the entire show, really. And it makes
Funnily enough, Donal and I were Vic's, always his sort of the people that he wanted to play these two parts, and it ended up that we both did, which is unique and unusual and wonderful in of itself. But also Vic didn't know that Donal and I mean, he knew that we'd been in films together and we'd had a long working relationship, but he didn't know whether, you know, how connected or not connected we were. So we started, Donal and I first met when we were in our 20s, and we made a film called Never Let Me Go with Mark Romanek. And all of us were very young in that. I've seen him sort of grow up. He's seen me grow up, you know, alongside each other. We've seen each other change over the years. We then made a film called Shadow Dancer where he played my brother. So there's this mutual respect from afar, but also because of work and because of where life takes you in the world and traveling around so much as an actor, estrangement. And not in a negative way between Donal and I, but the kind of distance that Alice and Jack experience in their long relationship that we go through 15 years of their relationship with them. And so that was wonderfully useful because, he, in the most honest way, he and I remember one another when we were younger, and we remember each other now. Mm-hmm. And that was a very beautiful thing. I think when my character, Alice, meets Jack, it's the first time she feels really hope. first time she finds faith in mankind, I suppose, especially in men, in heterosexual men. She's it's been very complicated for everything she's gone through. So it's just, and I think when she finds this precious thing in Jack, this hope, this open-eyed wanting to do well in the world and wanting to treat people well and wanting to make a difference, which is the exact opposite to her having gone into finance.
Yeah, and being amazing at it, very successful.
From her choices.
Yeah.
She's so, wants to protect him from herself, you know, and so for that reason, she pulls him in, pushes him away, needs to keep him at an arm's length in life. And their love can't really look like we all expect things to look like. But when does life ever look how you expect it to look? There is no formula. There's nothing. There are no shoulds. Every person's unique. We all of us need different things. There's nothing to subscribe to where love's concerned, or life, or anything in life is concerned.
There's no direct path, and there's no sort of you do this and then you do this and then this will magically happen. And we really see that.
I think we tell ourselves those reliable, you know, as an example, a romantic comedy or a wonderful Disney movie or, you know, old folklore. We tell ourselves those stories that we're familiar with to try and give ourselves hope and to process and understand love. But actually, I think what's really heartening about this piece is that in Alice and Jack, you have an experience of there's something in there that's so awkwardly, painfully real about the experience that it makes you feel less alone. And it's funny because of that as well. I think that's maybe the only similarity between, you know, Alice and Jack and the regime. And that's also out at the minute is that there's, you know, it's very moving in many ways, and it's also hysterically funny, can be really funny.
I love that you just mentioned that, just because I really, you know, thinking of Agnes and Alice, you know, quite polar opposite characters between your character in The Regime and Alice and Jack. And I'm looking back and thinking about your filmography. I mean, to Leslie, which you were Oscar nominated for, one of my favorite movies, Please Baby Please, which I absolutely adore.
I'm so happy that you love that.
Do you have a compass that leads you from project to project? Do you approach all of these different, to Leslie, the same way that you approach a regime, the same way that you approach an Alice and Jack or Please Baby Please?
It's interesting when people, so that's the question that I've been asked for, I don't know, the last 15, maybe even coming up to 20 years now, I suppose, like, which is, 15 years, I would say, because that's kind of when film, you know, when I started to sort of be more involved in film.
Yeah.
And I always feel this, you know, great sense of responsibility to come up with an answer that makes some sort of strategic sense, because I often feel like when I'm being asked it, I don't feel it so much when you asked it to me there, but I often feel when people ask it that they're trying to work a formula out that I might have adhered to or something.
Yeah, I'd be like, okay, well, how do I do this? Like, let me do that. You do this and then you do this. Yeah. Then.
I don't have, I think there's, what's really important is are the people.
Yeah.
The people attached to each project, you know, you talked about Please Baby Please, which I think is a just joyful, wonderful film.
A riot, yeah.
And it's directed by Amanda Kramer, who's an extraordinary writer, director, and I'm going to make a next film with her. And building relationships like that, when you look at all sorts of wonderful filmmakers and their long-standing relationships, and I mean the kind of filmmakers who, you know, you really look at their whole canon of work and you think, crikey, they've really changed the path of film in some way, or they, you know, those are the relationships I suppose I'm interested in.
Yeah.
You know, and just that kind of intimacy that allows you to be courageous, you know, be feel comfortable to be really brave, you know, in playing different, whatever you're playing. So yeah. the people, I think, are the most important thing.
I do have to say, this is the same topic, but I saw you across the room at the Vanity Fair Oscar party. You had an amazing dress. You looked absolutely fantastic. What was it like to return, 1 year after you're nominated to be back in that space, to be back in that room with people? Was it like, oh my God, I can't believe I'm here again? Or was it like, I know this. I know the score. I'm an old hat.
Well, I mean, to return in that extraordinary piece of clothing that I was wearing, which was in
and
of itself an amazing construct, to be stepping back into it with Jeremy in mind, Jeremy, again, people, I felt excited to do it, supported, it's really playful wearing these different things and, being in that environment. It's always such a strange environment. And I always feel so much more comfortable when I'm working with friends in it. And when I see friends, or I see longstanding work colleagues or, just people you've seen around for, 20 years, I sort of feel comfortable. I was very, very happy to, wear that incredible creation by Jeremy Scott, who I think has just so versatile and just a wonderful person.
Yeah. It really was absolutely a feast for the eyes. It was amazing. And it was so great. It was so great to see you, at the event, even if at a distance.
I wish you'd come up and tried to give me a hug. It would have been very difficult because I couldn't really move my left arm.
Your arms were sort of completely out in a beautiful way, but it would have been hard. But next time, I definitely will. I gotta say, before this has been so lovely chatting with you about Alice and Jack, and I love that you said that you produced this piece and that is a completely different art form in a way. I mean, it's absolutely tied to being an actress and making amazing entertainment and movies and television shows. But I would love to know, what was it like sort of stepping into the producer role and doing dual duty for Alice and Jack? And then is that something that you also want to continue to delve in? A path you want to go down?
Yes, that's something that I've been doing for about 12, 13 years now. And I really only had experience of it in film and really continues to be the focus because that's really my main area of interest. I just love film and theatre. And it came about because I got so sick of hearing myself moan about, you can only sort of feel uncomfortable for so long before you just do something about it.
Yeah.
And the things that led me to that were, all sorts of things, just horrible lack of representation, really wanting to work with these brilliant voices who weren't being given a chance or nobody was taking a chance on because they didn't have a huge body of work behind them, but they hadn't had the opportunity to actually give it a go and then show the world what they could do. And people need, especially writer-directors, young filmmakers need their first chance, which is almost impossible in this climate, as they call it, these days.
Totally.
So that's something that I just really, really have enjoyed, and I've made such great, really close friendships through that process. And really the first person that I did that with was Christina Cho, who directed Nancy, and she went on to win the writing award at Sundance for that film. And that was it was such a special moment for all of us because so many of those women, it was a mostly female crew, and so many of those women went on to, they were heads of department for the first time on that film. And then they went on to secure wonderful jobs on different things. And it's a small thing, but it feels like there's a little ripple of difference. I don't know what it'll end up being. I hope I will continue to work with Christina for the rest of my life, I hope. And she's, dear, dear friend. So it's really, that part of it's wonderful. Was it something that I aspired to be? Absolutely not.
Yeah.
I mean,
And, you know, there are all sorts of incredible characters like Bob Evans and, you know, all of those, a whole different era of producing that that produced an incredible era in film. Mm-hmm. But times have changed so very much, and it's nice to just think about doing things a bit differently, really, rather than just the way they've always been done. You know, there are so many different ways to do things, aren't there? And it's better, like, the more perspectives you have in the room together, the better, the more chance you have of doing something differently and representing different perspectives that have not been represented enough. So I enjoy it, yeah.
That does it for this week's show. We'll be back with our roundtable on Thursday. Thanks so much for listening. I'm David Canfield. You can find me at DavidCanfield97 on the internet. And Chris, where can they find you?
You can find me at Chris Triss.
Our editor and producer is Brett Fuchs.
I'm Alex Schwartz.
I'm Nomi Fry.
I'm Vincent Cunningham, and this is Critics at Large, a New Yorker podcast for the culturally curious.
Each week, we're going to talk about a big idea that's showing up across the cultural landscape, and we'll trace it through all the mediums we love: books, movies, television, music, art.
And I always want to talk about celebrity gossip, too.
Of course.
What are you guys excited to cover in the next few months?
There's a new translation of the Iliad that's coming out, Emily Wilson. Really excited to see whether I can read the Iliad again, whether I'm that literate. I mean, the jury is out.
I can't wait to hear Adam Driver go again in an Italian accent in Michael Mann's Ferrari.
He can't stop.
I mean, and bless him. I can't wait.
Molto bene.
Molto bene.
We hope you'll join us for new episodes each Thursday. Follow Critics at Large today, wherever you get podcasts.
You really don't want to miss this.
Don't.
Don't miss this.
Don't miss it.
See you soon.
From PRX.